Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. Hi, I'm Bill Barton from Barton Legal, and welcome to another edition of the Barton Legal Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Mino Han from Peat & Kim. Mino's based currently in Singapore. I first met him in Korea a few years ago. And as I always start these, Mino, do you want to introduce yourself in, you know, sort of a minute or so? However you would like to sort of introduce yourself to your unknown audience.
Sure, Bill. Thank you for having me. I am an arbitration lawyer, Korean qualified, used to be based in Seoul, Korea. I grew up in Germany when I was a child and was there until seventh grade, and always had, and I came back to Korea in seventh grade and always had this kind of homesickness, this longing of Germany. And just so occurred that I thought international arbitration, sounds international, would be the closest that would bring me back to Germany. Have started my career as a lawyer in this field. Realized it has little to do with Germany. It was very, very English sort of centric, Anglo-centric. Then I thought, okay, that's the closest I can get. It's still good enough. Until in 2019, by luck and coincidence, the head of our practice group asked me, Mino, are you interested in joining a Swiss-Korean disputes specialist firm? It's called Peat & Kim. I said, yes, of course. So I always wanted to do this sort of German-Swiss-European thing and almost had given up on the idea until I got this opportunity. Said yes immediately, and 6 years fast forward, here I am. We're very, very interested in doing work in Asia. We believe Asian companies should be represented by Asian disputes lawyers, which prompted me to move over to Singapore earlier this year. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, and that's a great answer. So, few questions. Have you ever done a podcast before?
I have done one podcast before that was more or less scripted.
Okay.
Never done something this open-ended before, and so I'd say no.
So I'll explain to anybody who hasn't listened to any of our podcasts before. The idea behind these podcasts is there's a lot of podcasts that are very legalistic in nature, and in fact, you know, as part of our podcast series, we do a legal bite size, so we deal with specific legal issues. But the aim and intention of the conversations was that I'm very fortunate to have met so many fascinating people such as Mino, and I wanted to encourage people to see construction arbitration in a different way, and to see the people who are involved, if you like, behind the scenes, the arbitrators, the litigators, the solicitors, lawyers, because I think it's the people that make the profession what it is. And we're phenomenally lucky to meet so many different and varied people. And so the idea was I would just have conversations with people and we'd just chat about anything and nothing in particular. And as Mino said, it's a bit unnerving because I don't give any questions out beforehand, simply because, as he said, you have to imagine that I'm having a conversation either over a coffee or a beer or a meal, and it's just sort of a general catch-up. But you've got this imaginary third-party audience that is listening in. And so there's always that little bit of tension. So what would you say is what's the most dangerous thing you've ever done, do you think, Mino? legally or otherwise?
The most dangerous thing. I wouldn't classify this as dangerous, but tying into the brief intro that I shared with you, Bill, is coming to a country that I haven't been to for 10 years, which is Korea, in sort of my teenage years. That was pretty nerve-wracking. During the 10 years I was in Germany, I attended a German school, was programmed and wired almost like a German child, although I looked Korean. I had never been to Korea during these 10 years, and the cultural shift was not necessarily dangerous, but it was very, very different. And so it was, to me, a big shift and a big cultural shock, I would say.
I think that's tremendously brave. I think that's what counts as it's the sort of flip side of the coin of dangerous. Your action was considered, but still very brave. I know you returned. You worked in Germany for a while when you were at CMS, didn't you?
I did a master's program in London in 2017 and 18, and I told my boss I want to do a secondment in Europe while I'm here. And as part of that, I wanted to tick the bucket list to work in a German law firm while I'm there. And so after the master's program, I did a short secondment in London and another one in Cologne in Germany, which is interesting because I told you that I had this homesickness, this longing, and I thought, okay, now I'm working in a German environment. This is what I wanted. Guess what? It was very different from what I imagined it to be. Being a child in an environment, being an innocent child, having fun with my friends, versus being a Korean lawyer surrounded by 99 other German lawyers in a professional context, it's very different. I felt, I didn't feel comfortable, to be honest, despite the fact that everyone was kind to me. I felt a bit alien and a bit strange. And you could even say I was part disillusioned as to sort of the fantasy that I had in my childhood. This is almost like meeting your first love when you're 40 and you sometimes think better not having met that person. But good that I have. It was a very nice experience, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. But for me internally, I was surprised that I didn't love it as much as I thought I would.
That's an interesting thought, because the way we grow up, we believe that we are, on the one hand, shaped by things, but we also somehow believe we're slightly immune. You know, you thinking you're immune as growing up as a German child, and this, and then moving away, and then coming back, that somehow you would be unchanged and it would just be fitting in. But it demonstrates, doesn't it, how you at different stages of your life have very big changes in your attitude and your experience with people. And it must be, I don't know, what was your experience of Singapore before? I mean, apart from presumably you'd been in Singapore because of the arbitration centre, but had you worked?
Yes. It's great that you brought up Singapore, Bill, because this, I think, is all related. Identity is not a static thing, I realize, as you mentioned. It's something that is being shaped, and there is some core element that wouldn't change, but there are also things that do change, I think. And over the time, I, without realizing, became more Korean than I thought I was. Interestingly, I felt somehow more safe and comfortable in a way when I was in London. During the master's program and during the secondment, partly because it's so diverse and there are so many different people in London, that being who I am, being a bit different, isn't strange. It's just normal to be as I am. And to me, Singapore is, it's a bit like the Asian version of London. It's very inherently very diverse. People are here from Chinese immigrants, Indian heritage, Malay, and also a lot of Korean people, Japanese people, as expats and also people from Europe or England are here, it's very, very normal to look like me, to have an accent like me, to speak like me, i.e. no one is like me, and hence it's very normal to be different. I think Singapore is, in that sense, mentally a very comfortable environment. And I love it here. I love that part of Singapore, sort of the different cultures blend in very nicely together. It's very natural and inherently very okay to be different.
I think it's, again, interesting that you, from, you know, early in your life, you wanted to sort of have a career. Well, ignoring the specific, you had in your mind being something that was international. And I think the places that you've been are very interesting. One of my sisters lived in Germany, obviously. She was there a long time ago. She lives in Luxembourg now. But Germany has transitioned. When she was living there, it was still normal for wives had to ask the husband's permission before they could say, you know, call their neighbour Mary or whatever the name is. And it was very formalistic. And it's the contrast of different countries that we don't know and don't appreciate until you spend a bit more time there. And then it's interesting that you grew up in Germany, you spent time somewhere else, and then you came back with that experience, which forms a contrast. And yeah, London's very diverse. I love Seoul. Seoul's one of my favorite. I've never been to Singapore. I must come. I love Seoul because it doesn't have as the same diversity as a lot of other places, but it's such a frenetic city, and I love the fact that there's just so many different parts to it, and people. I've always found the people to be incredibly friendly, welcoming, but I don't think a lot of people realise how driven, how ambitious Koreans are. And I'm interested to know your contrast, because I've seen lots of pictures of Singapore, and I think if anyone was asked about Singapore, they'd have this image of, you know, amazing glitzy buildings and all the rest. That I talk to people about Korea, they don't have that same image. And I'm always at pains to point out that I think South Korea is a long way ahead of, for example, London, in a lot of building design and attitude and drive. And Korea is a very dynamic, young country. How does that sort of compare with Singapore, do you think? Do you think, is Singapore as dynamic?
Just quickly on your last rumor, I think you have offended a few London-based designers or architects.
Probably.
I think architecture in London is brilliant.
I'm not knocking the architecture, but if you go inside a lot of the buildings, there are some beautiful buildings in London. But I don't think people understand how many amazing buildings there are in other cities, not just Seoul, that are London is catching up with. We have a distorted sense of our own position, I think, sometimes in London. I just wondered, because Singapore's relatively, you know, what's the Singapore identity, do you think?
Singapore identity to a person coming from outside, to me, seems to be it's post-1965. Singapore had its 60th birthday this year, meaning they consider themselves, or Singapore was founded in 1965 by Lee Kuan Yew. There isn't that much talk about pre-65. It's a lot about the modern Singapore that it currently is. To me, it's a very transparent society, and transparency has a lot of upsides. You can offer financial and legal services in a very transparent way. People, there's a high level of trust amongst the people as to compliance of rules and predictability and all that. the downside of that is perhaps it's inherent when you are a rule compliant person in a society, people wouldn't necessarily step out of a box to get to a goal, which can sometimes be, from a Korean point of view, Koreans are in that sense a bit more dynamic. They get to a certain point, not necessarily via the route that's prescripted. Sometimes there is a shortcut, sometimes they go roundabout, and sometimes they make it happen through other means, which makes things more unpredictable. I also accept and acknowledge that. So I'm not judging anything, any way of doing things is right or wrong. It's just an observation that I'm making.
Yeah.
Singapore is in that way more structured, more organized is the nice way of putting it. Some people say it's sterile, it's boring. I think people are describing the same phenomenon just with different adverbs.
But Singapore has made unbelievable strides in the area in which we both work, hasn't it? In terms of the number of arbitrations that are now based in Singapore is on the rise, and the Singapore Arbitration Centre is now, you know, certainly it's on a must be on a sort of a pretty even level with London. It seems to me the most of, well, not most, a lot of the contracts I see, it's Singapore seat.
Yeah, I think the way how the Singapore government is staffed is remarkable. They have the best elites in the whole government, and they are exerting concerted efforts as to making Singapore a disputes resolution hub. This is very strategic and business savvy, I would say. Have you recognized that they don't call their late August event Singapore Arbitration Week, but Singapore Convention Week? Have you thought about that? It's the mediation convention. They're sort of marketing mediation, and then have a lot of arbitration events and Singapore International Commercial Court events. And then they're promoting, it's not only about arbitration, it's about this dispute resolution as a whole. Come to us, and we have mediation services, we have court services, we have transparency, we have reliability. And the concerted marketing driven by the government is so effectively well done that, yes, it's reaping fruits and results. They're doing very well.
Yeah, and I think it is doing very well. I think that joined up approach is something that a lot of us in London, there's the great legal services, which is part of sort of DBT, Department of Trade, Business and Trade, and Ministry of Justice. But I don't think in the UK we have been as joined up, and certainly in our legal services, to promote recently London as the, as you say, a dispute resolution centre. I think we've relied on more historical elements. I know that there's a lot of work going into LCIA and also places like IDRC, but there's so many challenges. I mean, again, you mentioned Arbitration Week. Is there a week of the year that a city somewhere isn't having an Arbitration Week?
I don't know. I think the North Pole is still unoccupied, but otherwise it's really more arbitration weeks than weeks exist in a year. I just want to add one thing as to the remarkable business savviness of Singapore in terms of dispute resolution. It's an illustration, it's a snapshot of how they design their convention week. Which is every year they invite 30 to 40 young, up-and-coming disputes practitioners from all Asia. Or not even Asia, I think, from all around the world. And they do a workshop. It's a closed-door sort of free discussion workshop on very relevant topics on dispute resolution. combined with networking, and the Minister of Law would come and he would participate in group discussions. And I haven't seen any other country, any other jurisdiction, I can't imagine that any other country would do that, to foster sort of this think tank, this leadership group in the whole region, and make them de facto Singapore ambassadors. Because everyone sort of falls in love with Singapore, or at the very least sort of becomes a member of this group, of this thought leader group. And Singapore is in the center of that. And I couldn't imagine the Korean government doing replicating something like that. And that just shows how smart Singapore is doing this disputes resolution business as an industry.
Yeah, I mean, there are reports in the UK that come out every couple of years about the value of legal services. And I think you're right. Most countries or cities that are seen as arbitration centres don't have that joined up thinking. I totally agree with you. When Nick Emerson was president of the Law Society here, he was pressing very hard to make dual qualification easier, which it's a slightly different point, but similar in that. And I agree with him. If you make dual qualification from foreign lawyers so that they can dual qualify in England, then they are, which law are they likely to advocate and press for going forward? And it's likely to be English law. And in the same way, as you say, if I think it's a great thing. If you're inviting a number of up-and-coming lawyers from a region, of course they're going to advocate for Singapore. And they've then been there and they're talking from experience. And the whole appearance becomes one of openness rather than giving an indication that you're perhaps worried by the competition. The more it's about confidence, isn't it? If you appear confident and you're not worried, then I think that gets more engagement from people.
I fully agree, yeah.
How do you see from now you've worked in different places, how do you see the sort of the growth of Asia now? Do you see it being more self-controlled, in that there's this historical sort of colonial English law and English language and using London or New York? Do you see that the Asia region is now a more confident, you know, grouping of countries and people that is going to produce its own lawyers, arbitration centres, and dominate in terms of over the next 5-10 years?
It's a good question, Bill. I think English as the lingua franca and English law / common law will be still prevailing. That being said, I think disputes lawyers from Asia will be more seen in the coming 5 to 10 years, at least I hope, to represent companies or people from this region at the very least. And I think there is a good chance that that will happen, because international arbitration, the more that I experience it, is not only about what's in the contract and what is the law and what are the facts applicable to the law. It's not sort of 1 + 1 = 2. It's about explaining a human behavior within a business, international business transaction or business context. And imagine the parties to a business transaction, they all were good intended. They had a good intention to do something good, something profitable mutually. It's not that one party enters into a contract wanting to screw up something. It's generally not the case. It's just quite often that the way how communication is done, or the behavior, or the motivation, or sort of there are clashes that are not captured by the language of the contract, which then gets explained in the course of the dispute. And explaining this culture is quite often effectively done by lawyers coming from that region, or at least having a good understanding of that culture. And I think that is happening now in Korea, in China, in Vietnam, Singapore not to mention, of course, but lawyers from Asia dealing with cases for companies from Asia, I think, is very natural to me. And I think the trend will increase. Will they take over the world? I don't think so, but there will be more of them to be seen on the map.
World takeover will leave to other people from other countries. And one of the reasons I asked you that was because you are somebody that I admire greatly, because you're not only a very experienced lawyer, you've got a long list of publications, MSc and the rest, but you also do the majority of your own advocacy, don't you?
Yes, I do. I learned that a lot from my boss, who does a lot of his advocacy. And what he's paying attention to is how to put together the ingredients to a delicious dish. He is curating the story very carefully. And it's not all about the Shakespearean way of doing advocacy as a King's Counsel or back then Queen's Counsel would do. It's more sort of how do you impactfully deliver your story, of course, in a legal way. There is a framework to it, but there is some careful choosing of the ingredients and sort of arranging them in a compelling way. And that's something that my boss is doing very well, and I learned very much from him. I thought, okay, let's apply that technique and blend that with my personal style. And I tried it out. What I love in hearings doing advocacy is to learn from the opposing side how they do advocacy, what's effective of what they do. I did one with, I don't know if I can mention names, with someone from a well-known construction chambers on the other side. I learned a lot from her, became good friends also afterwards. And it's an evolving process, I would say, but I enjoy the learning part of doing advocacy.
Yeah, I think you can certainly mention names. I think it is an interesting dynamic, because in England, with our split profession, it's only in recent years that solicitors have earned higher rights of audience, and by and large, when I started nearly 40 years ago, I would do small claims, I'd go and do stuff in county court, you'd do hearings in, back then it was the Official Referees Court before it became construction, and you'd do initial hearings of arbitrations. But as I got older, the division became much greater, and it became very unusual not to have counsel. And of course, so now we're in England, we're very much fixed. There are a lot of solicitors with high rights of audience, but it's something that when I'm dealing with lawyers from other countries, they really struggle to understand why they might instruct me and then I go and instruct counsel to do something else. And that's why I say I admire you doing your own advocacy, because on top of everything else, to be preparing and know that you're going to do that representation, that's a lot of added pressure and preparation.
I could say the opposite, though, because I admire barristers doing advocacy, picking up the core issues and packaging them in a clear and concise way in the short amount of time that they have is just amazing. Whereas I was living the case for 2 years, and so perhaps looking from that angle, it might be, I would say, easier. But I admire people who are able to do that in a compressed manner. I wouldn't be able to do so, perhaps.
And I think the other point you raised about people understanding their culture and their commercial approach is very true. I think that all of us need to be far more international. And you know, we're having this conversation virtually. You still need to be meeting and understanding people face to face. And I think that's, as you say, an important dynamic, isn't it, of representing clients when you understand the cultural differences and background.
Yeah. That's why I think everyone during COVID was talking about new normal, but guess what? After Corona, no one is having virtual hearings, at least for the main hearings, because communication between people, it's not only about the words, it's not only about seeing me on screen, it's the whole body language, it's sort of the silence, the pauses in between, the way how you behave, the blink of an eye, and all those little cues that add up in conveying the message that you have in mind. And so seeing how lawyers or counsel speak, seeing witnesses, seeing experts from a tribunal's point of view, I think seeing them in person is very different from just seeing them on screen. And despite this convenient device that we have, I haven't had any experience whatsoever after COVID where a main hearing was done virtually. Perhaps it's because I lack the experience, but it's all in-person hearings, which I think ties in with your point, Bill. The in-person touch, sort of seeing face-to-face, is not replaceable, really.
Yeah, and you, just as you say, I find it very frustrating. Particularly, the more people you have on a meeting, which is virtual, the less effective I think it is, because as soon as you have sort of four or five people, there's always somebody who's drifted off and they're just on their phone, or they perhaps even left sort of the camera shot. And it's strange, isn't it, when you on camera, as you say, you miss all those little movements of hands or other indications of nerves or truth or things like that, which you pick up, don't you, over the period of your career. You begin to build up this sort of library of things that you think, oh, are they telling the truth?
Yeah, I fully agree with you. We are social animals. And we just function in a way that presupposes us to be in a group environment. We can't survive and live alone. We need to help each other, and we're very vulnerable human beings. And that, I think, enabled human beings to read the cues, to sort of behave socially and sort of interact with each other when we are together in a group. It's just very natural for us. And virtual meeting puts a lot of limitations on that. And so I agree with you, Bill.
We also need to, I think, to exchange ideas more. I mean, we've just taken on a Korean lawyer, and I find it very interesting that we have basics that we have are very different, but they, coming back to an early point you make, they do impact on how we view things. So we were in London yesterday, and of course he's very used to waiting for, you know, the green light to come on for the crossing the road, and I'm just grabbing him by hand, so, you know, crossing the road anywhere, nipping in between cars, which is complete anathema generally to, well, not just to Koreans, but sort of Asia, I think, generally, but also Australians. They don't cross the road just anywhere. But it's all these things are different approaches. And then you see behavioural change. So he's been giving his business card to people and, of course, presenting the business card and bowing. Now, the majority of people he's met would never, you know, you'd give a business card. I doubt nowadays a lot of people would even shake hands. But because he's presenting the business card, people are mirroring that back and bowing. And I find it is a very interesting social sort of experiment almost, that how quickly people are willing to adapt, you know, to make people feel comfortable in that way.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book Super Communicators, I think was the title, that I read last year, which was suggesting that human beings like to sync their wavelength, mm-hmm. and like to be feel very comfortable when they feel I have a lot in common with the other side. One of the things they do is mirroring the behavior of the other side. And then the question that the author put to the reader was, how do we sync each other better? How do we know what the other side is thinking, and what how do we sort of have on our radar their wavelength? And he suggested a very simple but powerful thing: ask profound questions. Ask questions in order to find out where the wavelength is lying, and try to sort of get the cues and build a rapport through the information that you get from these questions. So I found that advice very powerful, and it resonated with me because it touched on sort of human fundamentals, the way how we like to connect, help each other, and the environment that we feel comfortable in, which is something that we feel used to and something that's not unfamiliar to us. And so I keep agreeing with you all the time, Bill, today.
Well, no, but I think it's...
I can't it stop is,
It is a good thing because one of the things I love most is talking to different people, and you say about, you know, mirroring. And I find that I have an inherent belief that people want to help other people. But there are frequently things that during our life we don't realize that are being given to us as barriers. So and messages that people give. So people might say, oh, you know, you shouldn't help them unless they've helped themselves, or, oh, you shouldn't help them unless they've shown they've put some effort in, or, you know, do you see what I mean? Little words and phrases. And then I talk to people and say, oh, you know, go and ask somebody, that I'm sure they'll help you, or do you think... And there's a hesitancy. But as soon as you have a conversation with somebody, and you get into realizing that you're both, whether you're both lawyers or you will have some commonality somewhere, in that you both like football, or you both dislike football, or you both dislike a particular team or something, or you find a like. That mirroring in behaviour, not just your sort of folding hands and all the rest, then does facilitate a more open mind. And again, to me it comes back to seeing more dispute lawyers from Asia, from Korea, from Singapore, from Vietnam, Laos, other countries, actually representing their clients, I think will be a significant change in coming years, because they are going to have an inherent ability communicating native language, rather than always having to switch to English, to be able to be more local, rather than, you know, me trolling in from England. I think those are big things, and people are like meeting other people and like helping people. We live in an adversarial world, don't we, where you and I thrive on the fact that people have fallen out. But a lot of what you do is working in conjunction with lawyers on the other side, isn't it? It's not, the process itself isn't adversarial.
And yeah, for that reason, I, on the one hand, also want to grow personally as a disputes lawyer, but on the other hand, also together with that, I would like to grow together with lawyers from, say, civil law jurisdictions in Asia, China, Japan, Taiwan, Vietnam, Indonesia, Thailand, name them, and also share sort of the fortune or the luck that I had, because 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when the generation above me started international arbitration in Korea, I was told there was a sentiment, a Korean lawyer doing international arbitration? It's for the English. It's nothing for Koreans to do. It was seen like a Korean actor going to Hollywood and being mocked and ridiculed by that. Mm. Now see how K-pop and sort of Korean entertainment is taking over the world. It's unbelievable. And similarly, it requires, I think, a few bold and courageous people to take the first step. I was lucky to already have had that environment when I started arbitration. But not everyone in this region is in that situation. And so I, as much as I want to see other people as competitors, in fact, I would rather sort of see them as colleagues with whom I want to grow together and also share the experience that I gained from my professional life in Korea.
I think, and that is really spot on. And you know, this is a conversation. But you see, one of the reasons I started our webinars was for that reason, that I saw that as a result of COVID, there were so many people who don't have the advantages that we have in England or in larger law firms, where you have access to PLC and Westlaw and lots of books and other things. And the sharing of knowledge and ideas. I know that we're in a common law jurisdiction, but I, and this isn't, people don't always like it, I don't actually see that there is the difference that people want to make out between common law and civil law. And I think there's so much we can learn from other jurisdictions. So I've been doing a lot with the California Lawyers Association, with a chap called Larry Beagle. And they've been coming over to the UK for the last 10 plus years to meet people and learn things. And I was very lucky to be introduced to Larry by the late Paul Darling, QC as he was. And it's a fascinating thing that they have a totally different approach in America to litigation and the rest. And yet there's still so many things that you can actually learn. It's not to say that we like all those things, and some things you sort of have to ask, you know, well, why do you do that? And Larry asks me. But that's part of testing your own system, isn't it? It's part of, is actually what I do the best way of doing it? And I think you're right. There's, if you look at the countries around you and the drive, the new energy of people, there's so much going on for you to collaborate with, you know, lawyers from other countries.
Yeah, I think the California example is it's a great illustration that shows sophisticated business people do business all around the world. And then there are different ways of solving and resolving that conundrum, that tension, that conflict. It's not to say that one way of doing dispute resolution is necessarily the best or the right one. It's just different ways of solving a sophisticated problem that arose in a business transaction. There's a lot to learn from different ways of doing so. Why not? Yeah.
And so learning, do you think you're a good pupil? I, you know, I'm not necessarily, I don't know, it might be age or stubbornness or whatever. I frequently think I'm okay with law. I'll listen to people, but I struggle outside to sort of, if people are trying to teach me things, I get sort of impatient. Are you a patient person?
I think I'm generally open-minded and patient. I like to learn new things. I like to read books, which is a very boring hobby, but it's just who I am.
I don't think it's boring. We all need knowledge. I think it's that sharing, like you talked about, super communicators.
Yes.
It's translating information you get, isn't it, and sharing it with other people. And it makes, you know, like I've written it down, and I'm going to go and look that book up.
I really enjoyed reading. I'm generally a fiction reader, like to absorb stories and and the like. But I also enjoyed the book The Gene. It's a science book about evolution and DNA and the genes. It's written in a very, very compelling way by a medical doctor. And it was talking about the discovery of DNA and genes and gene technology and everything around that in a very captivating way. And so I think I'm not a bad pupil, I would say. Given the curiosity that I'm having.
Never been tempted to write a book? I mean, you've written a lot of articles, so...
Not yet, but I might do that at some point in my life.
Do you know Donald Charrett? He's always looking for authors for books. He's wanting to do a new version of one of his Fiddick books, so I'll volunteer you for that, and you can write a chapter.
I have already submitted a chapter to Donald for the first and second edition. So
there you go.
That's
then.
That's already done.
Oh well, tick that box off already. Well, look, Mino, it's been lovely to see you. Lovely to talk to you. I'm glad things are going so well in Singapore. I'm sure that
you're
going to be, continue to be a smash hit and be the kingpin of international arbitration in Singapore.
I don't know about that, but
I think it will. Thank you for spending the time, and I will make a note to come out for Singapore Convention Week very soon.
Yeah, when it's conventional to you. thank you, Bill, for having me.
Thanks, Mina.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.